Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be discussing in some detail the new asset class of litigation funding as an investment. And to do that, we're kindly joined by the founder of Axia Funder in Cormac Leach. Cormac, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Hi, Jonathan. Good to be here.
So we're going to be discussing in some detail and going into the different points around litigation funding and how it's working. And of course, Axia Funder, who Cormac has founded recently, is a specialist in this. But before we do that, Cormac, would you be able to give us a brief introduction to yourself and Axia Funder, please?
Yeah, sure. So, I've been in investment banking for something around 25 years, done a variety of different roles. Initially I was running a portfolio of interest rate derivatives, so managing hundreds of millions of pounds of swaps, captions, floors, complex financial products. And then I moved on from that to become a large cap equity bank research analyst and was working at bulge bracket banks like JP Morgan, ABN AMRO, writing lengthy tomes about large banks like HSBC, Barclays and so on, and then migrated into alternative finance. So I could see the whole fintech sector taking off. Got very excited about the potential to disintermediate or disrupt the banks. So got a very interest in alternative finance. And then briefly got into a situation myself where I needed some funding for a very strong commercial litigation case that I had myself. And my first reflex, having been in alternative finance, was to look for a alternative finance funding solution. I went on to Google, had a look, and really could only find one potential option in the United States, nothing in Europe. And then, I ended up getting funding myself from one of the traditional litigation funders. But I had it in the back of my mind that there was the potential to create an alternative finance solution aimed at the litigation funding market. And then a couple of years later, I had the opportunity to start my own business and then decided to take the plunge and set up Axia Funder, which is, as far as I know, the first for-profit litigation funding platform outside the United States. So, in the UK and Europe, and to my knowledge, is the only platform that allows investors, high net worth investors, sophisticated investors, to get direct access to commercial litigation funding opportunities and the potentially high returns that they can generate.
So you mentioned there, when you first looked, there wasn't a huge amount of options out there for people looking for funding of litigation cases. I mean, how has that evolved since that point? Is it still very much the same in terms that there's limited options? Of course, you mentioned there, Axia Funder is the only platform, to your knowledge, available for investors to invest in. But I mean, are there solutions for people that are looking for funding?
Yes, absolutely there are. I mean, so litigation funding is a relatively new asset class. As an industry, it's really only been active in the UK, I would say, for maybe around 15 years or so. It's certainly grown strongly over the last 5 or 10 years. But most of the providers of litigation funding are, operating on a kind of traditional model where they have a permanent pool of capital. They're set up as a private equity firm. Typically, a lot of their capital will be sitting in, Cayman Islands or, Jersey offshore. And they're really only catering to very, very large private equity firms and endowments and so on. And high net worth and sophisticated investors really cannot get access to the asset class, which has some unique characteristics. It has no correlation with the general market. Each individual case is not correlated with the next one. So you can potentially get very nice returns without any of the kind of typical macro correlation risk that you would have from equities or property. So in the next financial crisis, inevitably it will come at some point. Equities and properties typically will decline dramatically, you know, at the same time. And non-correlated assets like litigation funding, you know, will continue, we expect, to generate very solid returns, you know. So it's kind of an attractive asset class from that point of view.
So let's just talk now, Cormac, about the actual process from an investor point of view. And then from there, we can elaborate on some of the points, because some of them are actually quite fascinating. But, you know, in a very, you know, sort of broad sort of breakdown of a process for an investor that was looking to invest in litigation funding through the Axia Funder platform, what would that look like, and what would they have to do, and what would the process be?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So first of all, the investment product is quite complex. You know, this is a niche product, and it's, you know, it's really only aimed, therefore, at high net worth investors. So litigation funding is a relatively complex product and is relatively high risk, because each individual case, you know, you either win or you lose. So it's quite binary. Therefore, it's really our product is aimed at high net worth and sophisticated investors. And if they're interested in investing, they basically come to axiafunder.com, register, open an account. They're asked to do a suitability questionnaire, where they're asked various questions to check their understanding of what the Axia Funder product is. So before they take that test, they should really research on our blog and, you know, look at some of the frequently asked questions and so on the platform. Basically, they take that suitability questionnaire. Assuming that they pass that, then they're asked to put in, you know, identification and pass KYC, and certify that they're high net worth or sophisticated. And then once they get approved, then they come onto the platform, and there will be a range typically of available investments on the platform, and they click on the one they're interested in, and they're invited then to sign a non-disclosure agreement, confirm that they don't have any conflict with the parties to the litigation. And then they're presented with a lot of information. You know, there will typically be a video of a lawyer running the case, talking about the profile of the case. There'll be a 40-page information prospectus that we put together about the case. There will often be a data room with lots of additional information on the case. But to be clear, every case that comes onto the platform has already been very carefully and thoroughly vetted by the Axia Funder team. So, I mean, if you like, I can talk you through how we select the cases that we put in front of investors. Yeah.
Indeed. And please call me. That would be particularly interesting.
So, I mean, we very much realize that, you know, most high net worth sophisticated investors will not be litigation experts. Therefore, our guiding principle is that we only put cases onto the platform that we think are very high quality investments. So, you know, in principle, an investor could simply make an allocation of a certain amount of capital to every case that comes onto our platform. And we expect, you know, we can't guarantee, you know, returns are not guaranteed and capital's at risk, etc. But we believe that if an investor invests into every case that comes onto our platform on a portfolio basis, we expect they'll make, you know, 20 to 30% because we've carefully vetted the cases. And just to talk through how we vet the cases, you know, so far we have funded, I think it's 12 cases. And that's based on having looked at over 300 cases. So we have a very high rejection rate in terms of, you know, the number of cases we accept for funding on the platform. And to talk through the process, how we vet cases, the first thing we look at are the legal merits of the case. And the way we think about legal merits is kind of, there are two parts to it. One is we want to make sure that the claimants have the high moral ground. You know, it has to be a case where you look at the story of the case, and you look at the claimants, you look at the defendants, and there's a clear indication the defendants treated the claimants badly. You know, it's kind of, you know it when you see it, you know, the high moral ground. The second point is we just need to make sure that the legal technical merits stack up. You know, so for example, we need to make sure that we're within the time limitation. You know, when an event happens that such as there's a potential dispute, you typically have 6 years in the UK to actually file a claim. So, you know, that's one example of needing to have the legal technical merits. Then other aspects, you know, we need to make sure that the defendant has has money and has the ability and willingness to pay if there's a settlement or a judgment. There's no point in winning the case if the defendant doesn't have any money. Then we also look at the case economics. So we want to make sure that the value of the claim is big enough compared to how much it's going to cost to litigate. You know, because, you know, if you're spending, for example, £500,000, and then the ultimate judgment turns out to be only, let's say, you know, £1.5 million, then by the time, you know, the funder's been paid, the insurer's been paid, the lawyers have been paid, typically there's not very much left for the claimants. And that just doesn't really work, you know. So we'll only fund cases where the economics make sense. Then, you know, moving on, other criteria, we need to make sure there's a solution for adverse cost risks. So in the UK, if you litigate against someone and you lose, you're liable for their costs. Yeah, the loser in a litigation pays the cost of the other side. So basically every case pretty much that we fund, there are some special exceptions that we can go into, but in the vast majority of cases, we require that there is insurance in place to cover the costs of the other side in the scenario where the claimant does not win the case. And the reason for that is that if a claimant pursues a case and loses it, and the claimant doesn't have the ability to pay, then it, in principle, the investors could be liable to pay the cost of the defendant. So we always want to make sure that there's insurance in place to remove the adverse cost risk such that it protects investors. And we also want to make sure that the legal team representing the claimant are experienced. You know, they have clear credentials and you know, evidence that they've done similar cases in the past. We're big believers in alignment of interest. So we want to make sure that the solicitor is running the case to the maximum extent possible. And also the claimants have skin in the game. You know, so, you know, we believe that incentives really drive results. And, you know, the more of the solicitor's own fees that are exposed or contingent on a win, the more likely we believe the claimant is to win the case. And then, you know, there are various other things on the checklist. We want to make sure that litigation funding is allowed in the jurisdiction. Some jurisdictions still don't allow litigation funding. And, you know, just kind of, we also want to make sure the pricing makes sense relative to the risk. And we also want to make sure that there's enough capital being raised and allocated to the case to make sure that we have enough to finance the case right to the very end of the trial. We operate against those criteria, and we believe that, you know, if we rigorously vet cases based on those criteria, then we're going to generate good outcomes. And so far, touch wood, it's working well. You know, as I mentioned, we funded 12 cases, and of those, 5 cases have already resolved positively. 7 cases still ongoing, but we haven't had any cases go against us so far.
So there was a lot there. Cormac, there's a few points that I think would be quite interesting for listeners if you'd be able to elaborate on. And that's obviously the risk management side of things, and in particular, the insurance side of things. I mean, what's the sort of process behind that? You said that it's applied to all cases that you put onto the platform. I mean, is there a situation there could be issues with the insurance? That would obviously be a concern to investors. And what is put in place to make sure that, you know, investors are getting the best deal from any sort of insurance deals that you're doing to make sure that their losses are actually minimized?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, so typically we will source after the event insurance from investment grade insurance companies. And to be precise, it's actually the claimant getting the adverse cost insurance. So it's always good to look at the worst case scenarios. So suppose that we fund a case with 80 insurance in place, and, you know, we expect that, you know, at least 75% of our cases will win, and we can go into the reasons for that. I mean, the main reason is that 80 to 90% of cases settle before trial. But let's look at the other 25% of the cases that don't win. So then in that scenario, the claimants are liable for the cost of the other side. Now, as I mentioned, there's after the event insurance. So in the vast majority of those cases, the after the event insurance will be activated and will cover the adverse cost risks. However, being very pessimistic, there's a very small tail risk that the insurance will not pay out. And that could either be because the insurance company becomes insolvent, doesn't have enough capital to pay, or it could be that the insurance company decides that they're not going to pay out on the policy, either because the solicitor was negligent or the claimants didn't disclose all the information they should have regarding the case. Now, if the solicitor is negligent, as it happens, there's potentially then a lawsuit against the professional negligence insurance of the solicitor. But if the claimants have not disclosed all the information about the case, theoretically, the insurance company can repudiate the contract. Now, in practice, you know, I think, you know, when I speak to insurance underwriters, they say they've seen one instance of it in 20 years. So there's a very remote event. But in that event, the next thing that would happen would be that the judge or the court would look to the claimants to pay the adverse cost risks of the other side. But if the claimants, for whatever reason, did not have the ability to pay those costs, then the court could then look to the funder. And the way that we fund these cases is through a limited company. So, you know, because it's a limited company, it provides quite a lot of protection to investors. But theoretically, the judge can pierce the corporate veil, it's called, and look to jointly pursue on a pro rata basis the shareholders of that SPV. So we in our risk warning disclose that there's, to our mind, a very, very low risk that you could actually lose more than you invest into a case. So in principle, for example, if you invested £10,000 into a case, there's a very remote risk that you could lose that £10,000 plus another £10,000. So we, you know, in part for that reason, but also just because we think diversification in principle is a good idea because each one of these cases is binary, we encourage investors to invest into, you know, ideally 5, 10 or 20 cases to get a good spread of risk and actually just to completely minimize these very remote tail risks that theoretically are still lurking around the edges. Now, in some of our cases, we do have a thing called non-avoidable AT insurance in place, and that's a policy from insurance companies where they're effectively on the hook for the cover they provided, irrespective of whether or not the claimants have misrepresented the facts of the case. So as you can imagine, that protects investors more. So we seek that where as much as we can. We're also exploring other ways to completely eliminate these very remote tail risks. And so it's a little bit of a work in progress in terms of completely de-risking this. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, thank you very much for that comment. That's a very good explanation there. Of course, as you said, actually what happens in very rare cases, but I think it's good for listeners when they're trying to understand this, what the potential risks are. But as you said, the majority of cases and looking at your track record have been successful. So let's now focus, Cormac, on successful cases. And this is where investors would, of course, be receiving a return on their investment. And you said, was it 70% of your cases have been successful so far?
No, well, I mean, all of the cases that have concluded have been successful. So, you know, on your metric, that's 100% success rate. But, you know, we do have 7 cases ongoing. Okay. Where the outcome is uncertain.
Okay. So, you know, when you're looking at those cases, investors in each of those particular cases, what does it look like on the other side for them? What's the process if you have a case that you're successful in and you win? What sort of returns can investors expect from those, the time frames? Would you be able to get a little bit of details about that side of things?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just looking kind of at the glass half full side of the equation. I mean, so we did have a, you know, just to give you one example of a case that settled very recently. I mean, so I got approached by two entrepreneurs who were running a property development business, and they had got fire and theft insurance for one of their buildings. The building was then burned down by some teenagers. So it was an arson attack. They then went to their insurance company to claim on the policy. The insurance company refused to pay out, saying that they had not disclosed particular details about some SPVs that they had managed in the past. And they said, you know, that the details were completely not relevant to the insurance and actually managed to get insurance from another insurance company and having disclosed these details with no difficulty whatsoever. But the insurance company was playing hardball, refusing to pay out. These claimants came to us. We lined up solicitors, that were willing to work on 100% no win, no fee for them. We provided funding, and then they went back to the insurance company saying, we're fully funded to trial on this. And do you really want to have litigation here, or do you want to have a mediation? The insurance company completely changed its tune immediately and met for mediation and settled, you know, within a matter of weeks for, you know, about five times what they had originally offered. They had offered a very nominal sum initially, but then they offered, it was actually more, it was six times and the original offer they offered to settle. So that's a very good instance of, you know, a situation where when a litigation funder comes into the picture and adds some capital, levels the playing field between claimants with a strong case but no money and a deep-pocketed defendant with a poor legal merit situation. And in that, actually, it wasn't fantastic for investors because the case settled very, very quickly. But investors typically on something like that can look to make a very quick 15%. So, you know, it's a modest return because it settled so quickly. But, you know, more generally, we would expect cases to run for 1 or 2 years, sometimes 3 years. And if the case wins, investors can typically expect to be making 55 to 70% per annum on the capital. Now, of course, not every case will win, but on average, we think investors will be making, you know, well north of 20%. We're targeting around 30% per annum type return. And another thing I think that's important for investors to be aware of is that in many situations, we can put insurance in place that will protect, you know, the majority of investors' capital. So it sounds a little bit like having your cake and eating it. So if the case wins, you're getting returns of, you know, 50 to 70%. If the case loses, in some instances, you're only risking 20% of your capital net of the insurance in place. So it's a very asymmetric picture. And, you know, so I think for that reason, it's a very interesting niche. You know, there isn't room in this sector for a huge amount of capital to come in. But for investors who do get involved, I think the returns relative to the risk are really quite attractive.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Cormac. What I'd like to do now, and this is quite an interesting point, I feel, with litigation funding, is the correlation between more traditional assets. As you mentioned at the beginning, litigation funding can be classed as an alternative asset. And I know one of the attractions typically to alternative investments are the low correlation with traditional assets such as stocks and bonds. I mean, but how is that actually seen in the real world, Cormac? Because, you know, of course you'd think, you know, if people are around and they want to invest in certain cases, you know, there's an element of sentiment behind that. But what are you seeing in the real world in terms of how things are performing in terms of the correlation between litigation funding and traditional stocks and bonds?
Yeah, it's interesting in terms of investors' perceptions. I mean, it's a very unusual period right now, I think, because equities have had a very strong run recently. You know, residential property, I think, has had a strong run. So at the moment, because of QE and a lot of liquidity, virtually every asset class has been increasing in value. But, you know, I think more kind of forward-looking investors will probably realize or agree that, you know, there's limited upside for equities here. There's arguably limited upside for property, you know, at least on a real inflation-adjusted basis. You know, these asset classes have already had a tremendous run. So I think smarter investors will probably be looking around for alternatives. You know, either you move to cash, which is not great given inflation. You know, you can go into bonds, but again, on a real inflation-adjusted basis, most bonds are not going to generate a very attractive return at all. So, you know, I think the logic for investors making some allocation into litigation funding, you know, I don't know, is it 2% or up to 5% of their total investment portfolio? Excuse me. But I think it does make sense to make some allocation into litigation funding because it is non-correlated and the returns are very substantial, you know. So if 5% of your portfolio is generating 30%, you know, if you do the math, I think that adds 1.5% of total return to your overall portfolio. And, you know, mathematically, you're risking, you know, maximum 5% of the total portfolio. So, you know, I think the cost benefit of making some allocation to a zero correlation asset class like litigation funding makes a lot of sense. And then within that, I think it makes a lot of sense to spread your bets, you know, so each individual case we believe has an expected return of 30%. And obviously the more cases you can add, the more you reduce the variability or the volatility of those returns, because each case is not correlated with the next one. So, you know, as a thought experiment, if you're able to invest into 1,000 cases, your return in principle would be rock solid at 30% with no variability whatsoever. You know, where I contrast that, if you invest into just one case, you know, it really is quite binary, right? You know, it could be, you know, 100% loss, or, you know, 2x or 3x profit. So, you know, diversification is very important. I mean, the other point I would make is that at the moment, risk-averse investors may be thinking, okay, let's go to cash, put money into bonds. But when you factor in inflation, you know, inflation, I don't know what it's running at in the UK, but I think the last prints I saw were, you'll know better than me, but the last prints I thought were 3 or possibly 4% per annum. You know, inflation is ticking up. So if you're putting money into bonds, or, you know, even high quality peer-to-peer loans that are generating, you know, 1 to 3% on a real basis, you are, you know, your net worth is actually decreasing. And so to my mind, it does make sense to actually consciously take some risk and put money into something that is expected to generate 30% type return, because that is going to help you beat inflation in the context of your overall portfolio.
Indeed, indeed. So, Cormac, I just want to move on now to the ESG characteristics of litigation funding. Now, of course, everybody knows over the past 2 years, ESG investing, impact investing, has really grown substantially in popularity. And when doing the research for this podcast, that was something that became particularly apparent with litigation funding. Would you be able to just give us a little bit more details around that, how that would play into that theme of ESG investing?
Yeah, well, it's really very simple. You know, I strongly believe that litigation funding is a positive force. I mean, some people can view litigation funding as ambulance chasers that looking to prey on vulnerable people. But, you know, I've personally been in a situation where I needed litigation funding. And, you know, I can tell you, when you have a strong case, you're up against a defendant who has a lot of cash and, you know, is well positioned to defend their case, even though the merits of the position are very weak. That's a very stressful position to be in. And in a situation like that, litigation funder comes into the equation and completely levels the playing field. And claimants very often are willing to give up some of the upside of a case in exchange for the financing and effectively taking away the downside. So, you know, I very much believe litigation funding is a positive force, because it gives people access to justice. And, you know, there's a lot of research to show that if you protect property rights in a society, then GDP grows a lot faster and basically general prosperity increases. I mean, you could argue that's why the UK and the United States have grown much more quickly over the last 200 years compared to, for example, Latin America or Africa. I believe it's about protecting property rights and empowering entrepreneurs to take risks and get rewarded for those risks. And litigation funding to me is part and parcel of that, because time and time again, you see where hardworking, you know, entrepreneur enters into a contract with, you know, a large corporate or a larger partner, creates a huge amount of value. And then once the value is available and is supposed to be divided up fairly between the entrepreneur and the larger corporate or the larger partner just completely reneges on the contract and captures all the value themselves. Litigation funding in that scenario protects the entrepreneur, protects the equitable distribution of the value created. And for that reason, I think it's clearly a social good and deserves to be included within ESG investing.
Thank you. That's fantastic, Cormac. Just to finish off now, so people are just going to be listening to this, we're quite interesting in the way that it works. And there will be a link to anybody that's listening, the notes of this podcast will have a link through to the Axia Funder website, so you can check that out and see a little bit more about how it works. But if someone was to do that, Cormac, what would they expect to find there in terms of they thought they wanted to get involved? What would the process be? I know you did touch on it on the beginning, and what could they expect to find there in terms of currently active opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, so just for investors that are thinking about this, I mean, just to flag again, this is only aimed at high net worth and sophisticated investors. And actually, we're in the process of limiting access to the information on our platform going forward, such that it's harder for people who are not high net worth and sophisticated to access live opportunities on the platform. But currently, we do have two cases that are available for funding. The total funding that we're seeking is £900,000 across the two cases. One of them is about 63% funded. The other one's about 35% funded. One of them has more than half of the capital principal protected. We've carefully vetted both cases. We think they're very interesting. Typically we do expect to have one new case every month. And, you know, as you can imagine, it's quite a time consuming process to vet the cases, because every time we put a case on platform, we've already rejected 19 other cases that didn't make the cut, so to speak. We think it's a great product for high net worth and sophisticated investors. We do need to flag, though, you know, that people need to review the risk warnings carefully, and returns are not guaranteed and capital is at risk. But for people that are aware of that, then I think it should be an interesting investing proposition.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So that was Cormac Leach, who is the founder of Axia Funder. And as I did mention just then, if you do want to find out some more information, check out the notes of the podcast and you'll find a link through to their website. Cormac, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.